Track 2.
They touched sabres, and Aberley came at him, right foot leading, graceful as a dancer. A feint into the high line, and then, as Tom parried fierce and made the riposte, Aberley fluidly recoiled and made a counter-riposte in the line of engagement, fast as a striking viper. Tom attempted the correct parry, low quart, but his hand still lacked an inch of speed. It was a slither of steel over steel, and Aberley's blade stopped an inch from his nipple as it showed through the white shirt. "Faster, Klebby! Like a hawk!" Aberley admonished him, as Tom recovered smoothly, but his wrist was pronated and his blade slightly off line. It seemed he had left an opening for a cut to the right shoulder. Tom was furious and scowling at the hit against him, but he spotted the opening. Even from the high window, Hal saw him make the mistake of signalling his move with a slight lift of his chin. "No, Tom, no," he whispered. Aberley was dangling the bait that had snared Hal himself so often when he was Tom's age. With consummate judgment of distance, Aberley had set himself up 2 inches beyond the reach of Tom's cut to the shoulder. He would hit him again if Tom tried for it. Hal crowed with delight as his son took a double step, a feint for the shoulder, and then with the agility of a monkey and an extraordinary strength of wrist for his age, he changed his angle of attack and went instead for Aberley's hip. "Oh, you almost had him," Hal whispered, as Aberley was forced to extreme extension to protect himself with a circular parry that gathered Tom's blade and swept it back into the original line of engagement. Aberley stepped back and broke off the engagement. He shook his head so that drops of sweat flew from his bald head and flashed his teeth in a huge white smile. "Good, Klebby. Never accept an enemy's invitation. Good. You came close to me there." He placed one arm around Tom's shoulders. "That is enough for one day. Master Walsh is waiting for you to take up the pen rather than the sabre." "One more hit, Aberley," Tom pleaded. "This time I will have you fair and square." But Aberley pushed the boy in the direction of the inn door. "Aberley judges it finely," Hal said to himself with approval. "He will not drive them beyond their years and strength." He touched the white scar on the lobe of his own right ear and grinned ruefully. "But the day is not far off when he will tap a drop or two of Master Thomas's raspberry juice, as he once did mine, to moderate the boy's fine opinion of his own skills." Hal opened the casement and leaned out. "Aberley, where's Big Danny?" Aberley wiped the sweat from his forehead with his forearm. "He was working on the carriage. Then he went off with that new lad, Wilson." "Find him and bring him up here. There's something I have to tell you." A little later, as the two big men shuffled in, Hal looked up from the document on the writing desk in front of him. "Sit down, both of you," he indicated the bench, and they sat side by side like two overgrown schoolboys about to be chastised. "I had a word with Mabel," Hal picked on Daniel first. "She says she cannot abide another winter with you prowling around the cottage like a chained bear. She begged me to take you off somewhere far away." Daniel looked stunned. Mabel was his wife, the head cook at High Weald, a plump, cheerful woman with red cheeks. "She had no call," Daniel began angrily, then broke off into a grin as he saw the sparkle in Hal's eyes. Hal turned to Aberley. "As for you, you black devil, the mayor of Plymouth tells me there's been a plague of bald brown babies born in the town, and all the husbands are loading their muskets. It's time we got you away for a while also." Aberley rumbled and shook with laughter. "Where are we going, Gundwani?" He used the pet name with which he had christened Hal as a boy, and which meant cane rat in the language of the forests. He seldom used it these days, only in moments of great affection. "South," Hal answered him, "past the Cape of Good Hope, into that ocean you know so well." "And what will we do there?" "Find a man named Janjiri." "And when we find him," Aberley went on, "we will kill him and take his treasure for our own." Aberley pondered a moment. "That sounds good to me." "What ship?" Big Daniel asked. "The Seraph. An East Indiaman, fresh off the builder's slip, 36 guns and quick as a ferret. Or what does seraph mean? A seraph is one of the highest order of heavenly angels. That's me to the letter Z, Daniel showed all his pink gums in a wide smile. Of course, he could not read, and knew of the letter Z only by repute, which made Hal smile inwardly. When will we lay eyes on the seraph? He demanded. First thing tomorrow. Have the carriage ready at dawn. It's a long haul up to the company's yards at Deptford. Hal stopped them from rising. Before then, we have much to do. To begin with, we have no crew. They both sobered immediately. Finding a crew for a new ship, even a fifth rate, was always a difficult task. He held up the document that lay on the desk in front of him. It was a poster he had drafted the day before, and sent down to the printers in Cannon Street with Walsh. This was the first pull of the press. "Prize money! Hundreds of pounds!" the headline bellowed in thick black type. The text below it was smaller in size, but no less flamboyant and rich with hyperbole, scattered with exclamation marks and high-caste letters. "Captain Sir Hal Courtney, hero of the Dutch wars, master mariner and famous navigator, captor of the Dutch galleons Standvastigheid and Heilige Nacht, who in his fabled ships Lady Edwina and Golden Bough has pursued many capital voyages to Africa and the Spice Islands of the Indies, who has fought and vanquished the foes of his sovereign majesty with great capture of rich treasures and vast booty, has berths for good men and true on his new ship Seraph, a 36-gun East Indiaman of great power and speed, fitted out and victualled with attention to the comfort and care of officers and men. Those seamen who have had the good fortune to sail under Captain Courtney on his previous voyages have shared prize money as much as £200 each man. Sailing under letters of marque issued by His Majesty William III, God bless him, Captain Courtney will seek out the enemies of His Majesty in the ocean of the Indies to their confusion and destruction and the winning of rich prize, of which one half to be shared by officers and crew. All good seamen seeking employment and fortune will be heartily welcome to take a pot of ale with Big Daniel Fisher, the chief warrant officer of the Seraph, at the Plough in Taylor's Lane. Abberley read it aloud for the benefit of Big Daniel, who always claimed that his eyes were too weak for the task, but who could spot a gull on the horizon and carve the finest details on his model ships without the slightest difficulty. When Abberley had finished his recitation, Daniel grinned. "Ah, it is too good a chance to pass by, and this famous captain is the man for me. Damn me, but I think I'll put my cross on his watchbill." When Master Walsh returned from the printers, staggering under a heavy bundle of posters, Hal sent Dorian and the twins to help Abberley and Daniel nail them up on every street corner and on every tavern and bawdy house door along the river and the docks. Abberley pulled up the carriage on the hard of the shipyard. Hal leapt down impulsively and strode to the edge of the Deptford jetty, where Big Daniel and Alf Wilson were waiting for him. The river was thick with shipping of every class, from bumboats to first-rate men-of-war. Some were merely hulks, while others were in full sea-going rig, with yards crossed and sails set, as they ran downriver towards Gravesend for the channel, or tacked slowly up against the wind and the stream, headed for Blackwall. In all this multitude there was no mistaking or overlooking the Seraph. Hal's eye went to her immediately, as she lay at anchor out in the main current, surrounded by lighters, her decks teeming with carpenters and sailmakers. As Hal watched, a huge water barrel was swayed up out of one of the lighters and lowered into her open hatch aft. "Oh, you beauty," Hal whispered, as he ran his eyes over her in almost lascivious pleasure, as though she were a naked woman. Although her yards were not yet crossed, her tall masts had an elegant rake, and Hal could visualize the vast cloud of sail they could carry. Her hull was a happy compromise. She had the beam and depth to accommodate a heavy cargo, and her inventory of cannon as befitted her role as an armed trader. Yet she had such a fine entry at the bows and pretty run at the stern as promised speed and handiness in any condition of wind. "She will point high as you could wish, Captain," and sail away on a fairy's fart," Big Daniel said gruffly behind him. It was an indication of his own enchantment that he had spoken unbidden. The Seraph was dressed in splendour, as befitted the pride and prestige of the East India Company. Despite the lighters that clustered around her and partially screened her from scrutiny, her paintwork showed through, sparkling in the pale spring sunlight. She was all gold and blue, her quarter galleries intricately carved with hosts of cherubim and seraphim, and her figurehead the winged angel with the face of a child for which she was named. Her gun ports were picked out in gold, a pleasing checkerboard pattern that emphasized her force. "Hail a bumboat!" Hal ordered. And when one came in and tied up at the slimy stone steps, he ran down lightly and stepped into the stern sheets. "Run us out to the Seraph," Big Daniel told the ancient who sat at the tiller, and pushed off. The skiff stank of sewage, and her decks were stained with it. Probably one of her duties was to remove night soil from the officers' cabins of the ships anchored in the river, but by day she carried vegetables and passengers out to the fleet. "You be Captain Courtney, the new master of the Seraph?" the boatman quavered. "Seat your poster at the tavern." "That he be," Big Daniel answered, for Hal was too intent in studying his new love to hear the question. "I have two fine strong lads as want a ship aboard with you," the old man went on. "Well, send them to see me," Big Daniel growled. In the 3 days since they had hung the posters, he had recruited almost a full crew. There would be no need to visit the jail and bribe the warden to send his most likely prisoners aboard the Seraph in chains. On the contrary, Daniel had been able to pick and choose from the mob of unemployed sailors that had besieged the inn. A berth in a company ship was in high demand. The living conditions and the pay were infinitely better than those in the Royal Navy. Every loafer in the ports and every sailor stepping off an inward-bound ship knew full well that if war was declared against France, the naval press gangs would be scouring every port in Britain and hauling aboard the warships the men they caught. Every fool knew that it was wiser to grab a plum berth now and ship out to the far oceans before they began their dread work. The master shipbuilder on the Seraph's quarter-deck had recognised the tall figure standing in the bumboat's sheets as a man of quality and guessed his identity. He was waiting at the rail to welcome him when Hal came up the ladder. "Ephraim Green at your service, Captain." "Show me the ship, Mr. Green, if you please." Hal's eyes were already darting from the topmasts to every corner of the deck, and he strode off towards the stern with Green scurrying to keep up with him. They went through the ship from the bilges to the main topgallant, and Hal snapped terse instructions to Big Daniel when he found the smallest thing that was not to his entire liking. Daniel grunted at Wilson, who scribbled a note in the leather-bound book he carried under his arm. Already Daniel and Wilson were shaping into a good working team. When Aberley took Hal back to the inn, he left Daniel and Wilson to find quarters for themselves in the confusion of timber and sawdust. Bundles and bags of new canvas sails and great coils of fresh hemp that cluttered the between decks of the Seraph. They would hardly have time to step ashore again until the ship was ready to sail. "I'll be back tomorrow early," Hal promised Big Daniel. "I'll want a list of stores that are on board already. You can get that from Master Green. And another list of those we yet lack."
"Aye, Captain."
"Then we'll work out a load manifest and start to get her trimmed out for her best attitude of sailing."
"Aye, Captain."
"Then in your spare time you can start to encourage Master Green and his lads to shake out a little more canvas and get us ready for sea before winter sets in." During the afternoon a nasty little wind had sprung up out of the northeast, which smelt of ice and made the men huddle into their cloaks as they stood on the open deck. "It is on an evening such as this that the warm southern winds seem to whisper my name," Hal smiled as he took his leave of them. Big Daniel grinned. He could almost smell the hot dust of Africa on the monsoon. It was well after dark when the carriage rolled into the cobbled yard of the Plough, but all three of Hal's sons rushed out of the warm lamplit front parlour to welcome him before he stepped down from the carriage, and they trailed him up the stairs into his private salon. Hal shouted for the landlord to bring him a pewter jug of mulled wine, for he was chilled by the turn in the weather, then threw off his cloak and dropped into a high-backed chair before he faced the line of solemn boys who stood before him. "To what do I owe the honour of this deputation, gentlemen?" He put on a serious mien to match that of the young faces before him. Two heads swiveled towards Tom, the acknowledged spokesman. "We tried to sign up for the voyage with Big Daniel," Tom said, "but he sent us to you." "What is your rating and what experience do you have?" Howell teased them. "We have naught but a good heart and a will to learn," Tom admitted. "That will serve for Tom and Guy. I will rate you captain's servant, and you will draw a guinea a month's pay." Their faces lit like the sunrise, but Howell went on swiftly. "But Dorian is still too young. He must stay at High Weald." There was an appalled silence, and the twins turned to Dorian with stricken expressions. Dorian struggled with his tears and only just held them back. "Who will look after me when Tom and Guy have gone?" "Your brother William will be master of High Weald while I'm at sea, and Master Walsh will remain with you to see to your lessons." "William hates me," said Dorian softly, with a tremor in his voice. "You are too harsh on him. He is strict, but he loves you." "He tried to kill me," Dorian said, "and if you are not there, he will try again. Master Walsh will not be able to stop him." Hal began to shake his head, but then he had a vivid mental picture of the expression on William's face as he held the child by the throat. For the first time, he faced the unpalatable reality that Dorian's extravagant claim might not be too far from the truth. "I will have to stay and look after Dorian," Tom broke the silence, his face pale and set. Hal understood intuitively how much that offer had cost him. Tom's whole existence revolved around the thought of going to sea, yet he was prepared to give that up. Hal felt such devotion tug at his heart. "If you do not wish to stay at High Weald, Dorian, you can go to your Uncle John at Canterbury. He is your mother's brother, and he loves you almost as much as I do."
"If you truly love me, Father, you will not leave me behind. I would rather have Brother William kill me than that."
Dorian spoke with a conviction and determination strange for one so young, and Hal was taken aback. He had not been prepared for such steadfast refusal. "Tom is right," Guy agreed staunchly. "We can't leave Dorian. None of us can. Tom and I will have to stay with him." More than any other, Guy's petition swayed Hal. It was almost unheard of for Guy to take a strong stance on any issue, but when he did, no threat would move him. Hal frowned at them while his mind raced. Could he take a child of Dorian's age into a situation that would certainly mean terrible danger? Then he looked at the twins. He remembered that when his mother had died, his own father had taken him to sea, and he had been how old? Perhaps a year or so older than Dorian was now. For once, he felt his determination waver. Then he considered what dangers they would surely face. He imagined Dorian's perfect body torn by a storm of flying splinters as Roundshot crashed through a wooden bulkhead. He thought of shipwreck and the child thrown up, drowned, on some deserted wild African beach to be devoured by hyena and other loathsome beasts. He gazed at his son, at the red and gold head as innocent and lovely as the carved seraphic angel at the bows of his new ship. He felt the words of refusal rise again in his throat. But at that moment Tom placed his hand protectively on his younger brother's shoulder. It was a gesture without guile, but with a calm dignity, love and duty, and Hal felt the words to deny him dry in his throat. He took a slow breath. "I will think on it," he said gruffly. "Go now, all three of you. You've given me enough trouble for one day." They backed away, and at the door chorused, "Good night, Father." When they reached their own chamber, Tom held Dorian by both shoulders. "Don't cry, Dorry. You know that when he says he will think on it, he means yes. But you must not cry ever again. If you are coming to sea with Guy and me, then you have to act like a man. Do you understand?" Dorian gulped and nodded vigorously, not trusting himself to reply. There was a long line of carriages in the mall outside the entrance to St. James's Palace. The building was a fantasy toy soldier castle with battlements and towers built by Henry VIII and still used by the reigning sovereign. When Howe's carriage eventually pulled up, two footmen came forward to open the carriage door, and the secretary whom Lord Hyde had sent to fetch him led him through the palace gates and across the courtyard. There were pikemen in steel helmets and half-armour at the entrance to the stairway leading up to the long gallery, but when the secretary showed his credentials they let Howe pass, and a footman announced him in a stentorian voice, "Captain Sir Henry Courtenay!" The guards saluted with a flourish of pikes, and Howe filed up the staircase behind the Spanish ambassador and his entourage. When he reached the top, he found that the entire length of the gallery was crowded with a splendid assembly of gentlemen and such a collection of uniforms, medals, stars, plumed hats and periwigs that Howe felt like a country bumpkin. He looked around for the secretary who was guiding him, but the idiot had vanished in the throng, and Howe was at a loss as to what he should do next. Yet he had no call to feel out of place, for he was wearing the new burgundy-coloured velvet suit that he had had tailored for the occasion, and the buckles of his shoes were solid silver. Around his neck he wore the order of an Ottonier knight of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail, which had belonged to his father and grandfather before him. It was a magnificent decoration. On a massive gold chain hung the Golden Lion of England with ruby eyes, holding in its paws the globe of the world with diamond stars of the heavens twinkling above. It matched in splendour any of the myriad other orders and medals that glittered down the length of the gallery. At his hip hung the blue Neptune sword, the blue sapphire, big as a pullet's egg, glowing on its pommel, the scabbard worked in gold inlay. At that moment an avuncular grip closed on his elbow, and Hyde's voice murmured in his ear, "I am pleased you could come. We need not waste too much time here. 'Tis but a gathering of peacocks showing off their tails. But there are some it might be worth your while to meet. Let me present you to Admiral Shovel. He is to be the governor of the new naval shipyards that the King is building at Devonport. And there is Lord Aylsham. A good man to know. He gets things done." Oswald Hyde led Howe adroitly through the press, and each knot of men opened invitingly at his approach. At Hyde's introduction they studied Howe keenly, noting him as someone of importance simply because he was the protégé of the Chancellor. Howe realised that Hyde was working his way gradually towards the panelled doors at the end of the gallery, and once there he took up a position where they would be among the first to encounter whoever came through. Hyde leaned closer to Howe and murmured, "His Majesty signed your commission in Cabinet yesterday." He slipped the roll of parchment out of his sleeve. It was tied with a red ribbon and secured by a wax imprint of the Great Seal of England. "On y soit qui mal y pense." "Guard it well." He placed it in Hal's hand. "Have no fear," Hal assured him. "That scrap of parchment might be worth a vast fortune and a peerage." At that moment there was a stir, and a murmur ran along the gallery as the doors were thrown open. William the Third, King of England and Stadtholder of the Netherlands, stepped through on small, neat feet in slippers encrusted with seed pearls and gold filigree. Everyone in the gallery bowed in unison. Of course, Howe had known of his deformity, but the actuality came as a shock. The King of England stood not much taller than Dorian, and his back was hunched so that the scarlet and blue mantle of the Order of the Garter rose in a peak behind his small, bird-like head, and the massive gold chain of the Order seemed almost to weigh him down. Beside him, his wife, Queen Mary II, towered over him, although in truth she was only a young, slender girl in her 20s. The King saw Hyde immediately and nodded for him to approach. Hyde bowed low before him, sweeping the ground with his hat. 2 paces behind, Howe followed his example. The King looked at him over Hyde's back. "You may present your friend," he said, in a heavy Dutch accent. He had a deep, strong voice, out of place in such a childlike form. "Your Majesty, I present Sir Henry Courtenay." "Oh, yeah, de Mariner," said the King, and he gave Hal his hand to kiss. William had a long, beaked nose, but his eyes were wide-set, bright and intelligent. Hal was amazed that he'd been so readily recognised, but he said in fluent Dutch, "May I assure your Majesty of my loyal devotion?" The King looked at him sharply and replied in the same language, "Where did you learn to speak so well?" "I spent some years at the Cape of Good Hope, Your Majesty," Hal replied.
He wondered if the king knew of his imprisonment at the Dutch castle there.
William's dark eyes sparkled with amusement, and Hal realized that he did. Hyde must have told him. Strange it was that this King of England had once been its bitter foe, and that as a soldier he had bested many of the English generals who now stood along the gallery ready to pay him deep respect and allegiance.
"I expect to have good reports of you before long," said the little man, and the Queen nodded to Hal. He bowed again as the royal entourage moved on down the gallery.
Hal's presentation was over.
"Follow me," said Hyde, and led him surreptitiously to a side door.
"That was good. The king has a remarkable memory. He won't forget you when the time comes to claim those rewards of which we spoke." Hyde held out his hand.
"These stairs will lead you down into the courtyard.
Farewell, Sir Hal. We will not meet again before you sail. But I too expect to have good reports of your exploits in the Orient." The two ships went downriver in company. The Seraph led, with the Yeoman of York trailing her by two cables' length. The Seraph still had workers from the shipyard aboard. They had not been able to complete her final fitting out by the date they had so faithfully promised, but Hal had sailed nevertheless. "I'll send your men ashore when we reach Plymouth," he had told Master Green, the shipbuilder. "If they have finished their work when we reach there. If they haven't, I shall drop them in the Bay of Biscay and let them swim home." The handling of the ship was still clumsy as the crew settled in. Hal glanced back over his stern and saw how, in sharp contrast, the yeoman's crew worked their sails with speed and expertise. Edward Anderson, the captain of the yeoman, would be watching him too, and Hal flushed with mortification at the ineptitude of his men. That would change before they reached Good Hope, he vowed. When they reached the open water of the channel, the wind veered and strengthened into an autumn gale. The sun went behind the clouds, and the sea turned sullen green and boisterous. The night came on prematurely, so that the two ships lost contact with each other in the darkness before they passed Dover. For some days the Seraph slogged into a head sea, but at last they were off the Isle of Wight, and Hal found the yeoman only 4 miles distant and on the same tack as he was.
"Good," he nodded, and closed his telescope. He had reserved his judgment on Anderson. The yeoman's captain was a burly Yorkshireman, red-faced, unsmiling, and taciturn, who, it seemed, resented having Hal placed in authority over him. But during those first days he had proved that, if nothing else, he was a reliable seaman. Hal switched his attention back to the Seraph. Already the crew's ship handling was improving with practice in these conditions, and the men seemed cheerful and willing, as well as they should. Hal had offered good wages to secure the best, making up the difference over what the company offered out of his own pocket. At that moment the three boys came pelting up the companionway together, released by Master Walsh from their studies. They were excited and boisterous, showing not the least sign of seasickness after their time afloat in half a gale. Aberley had been able to outfit them with sea-going clothing in London, where there were numerous chandlers along the docks. They were better turned out than Hal had been when he sailed for the first time with his father. The old man had not believed in spoiling him, and he remembered the petticoats of rough canvas and tar-daubed pea-jacket, stiff with salt crystals that had rubbed him raw under his arms and between his thighs. He smiled ruefully at the memory of how he had slept beside Aberley on a damp straw pallet on the open deck with the other common seamen, had eaten his meals crouched beneath the shelter of one of the guns, using his fingers and dirk to spoon the stew out of his pannikin and break the hard biscuit, had used the leather bucket in the heads for his private business, and never bathed from the beginning of a voyage to the end. "It did me little harm," Hal recalled, "but on the other hand it did me little good. A lad does not have to be reared like a pig to make him a better seaman." Of course, the circumstances of his first voyages with his father had been different. The old Lady Edwina had been less than half the size of the Seraph, and even his father's cabin had been a dog kennel compared to the spacious stern cabin which was now at Hal's disposal. Hal had ordered the workmen to partition off a small section of his own quarters, hardly larger than a cupboard, and build 3 narrow shelves to serve as bunks for the boys. He had signed on Master Walsh as captain's clerk, over the tutor's protestations that he was no seaman.
He would continue his instruction of the boys, using his own tiny cabin as a schoolroom. Hal watched now with approval as Daniel seized the whooping, skylarking boys as soon as they appeared on deck and sternly sent them to the duties he had devised for them. He had separated the twins, placing Tom in the starboard watch and Guy in the other. They were always a bad influence on each other. Guy's proximity encouraged Tom to show off, while Tom distracted Guy with his antics. Dorian was sent to the galley to help the cook bring up the breakfast. Hal felt a pang of anxiety that Daniel might send the twins aloft to help handle sail, but he need not have worried. The time would come for that when their sea legs were hardened, and they had learned to balance easily on the heeling, plunging deck. For the time being, Daniel kept them on the open deck, helping to handle the sheets. Hal knew he could leave the boys under the big man's watchful eye, and turn his attention to the problems of his own seamanship. He paced up and down the quarter-deck, tuned now to the hull beneath him, the feel of how his ship responded to every alteration and trim of sail. "She's down in the bows," he judged, as she took a green wave on board, and the water streamed back down the deck and poured out through the scuppers. Over the last days he'd been visualizing how he could reload the cargo in the hold, especially the heavy water barrels, to achieve the trim he wanted. "I can put 2 knots of speed on her," he estimated. Childs was sending him on a warlike expedition, but nevertheless the main concern of the East India Company was always profit, and the Seraph's hold was crammed with a variety of trade goods for delivery to the company factories at Bombay. While part of his mind was busy with the loading and trim, the other part was on his crew. He was still short of watchkeeping officers. This was the main reason why he was putting in at Plymouth, instead of hauling away directly to round Ushant on the French coast, cross the Bay of Biscay, and head south for the bulge of the African continent, and eventually for Good Hope. Plymouth was their home port, and Daniel and Aberley knew almost every man, woman and child in the town and surrounding countryside. "I can fill the watch bill with the best men in England within a day of setting foot on the Plymouth dock," Daniel had boasted to Hal, who knew it was true. "My Uncle Ned sent word that he'll be waiting for us there," Wilson had said, to Hal's satisfaction. He had set his heart on having Ned Tyler aboard the Seraph. Apart from the necessity of finding crew, there were other reasons for this detour. Powder and shot were virtually unobtainable in London. The Irish War had led to the shortage of munitions, and now, with a French war in the offing, the Admiralty was hoarding every barrel of powder and every round of shot. It had even embargoed the factories to take every scrap of their production. One of the warehouses Hal owned at the Plymouth docks was piled high with powder kegs and iron shot. He had stored these here in preparation for the last voyage of the Golden Bough, which he had been forced to abandon when Dorian's mother had died and left him with a baby to care for. Although several years old, the new powders Hal had stored did not deteriorate as fast as the older types, and should still be in good condition. The final reason for the stop at Plymouth was that Childs had passengers for him to convey to the company's factory at Bombay Island. They would be waiting for him in the port. Childs had not told him how many he was sending, and Hal hoped that they would be few. Accommodation was at a premium in any ship, even one of Seraph's size, and some of his officers were bound to be evicted from their cabins to make space for them. So engrossed was Hal with all these problems that it seemed little time had passed before they had the Isle of Wight abeam. Then they were rounding Gurra Point, heading down the Sound past Drake's Island, and Plymouth Hoe was opening before them. On shore, a few dozen idlers had seen the 2 fine ships coming down the Sound and had lined the waterfront to watch them tie up. Daniel stopped beside Hal and murmured, "Do you see that head of silver hair shining there like a beacon?" He pointed with his chin towards the quay. "You cannot miss it, can you now?" "Dear God, it's Master Ned," Hal laughed. "And that's Will Carter with him. Ned must have laid a line on him," Daniel agreed. "A good lad is our Will. With him as third and Ned as mate, looks like you've got all your watchkeepers, Captain, sir." As soon as they tied up alongside, Ned Tyler was the first on board, and Hal had to restrain himself from embracing him. "It's good to see you, Mr. Tyler." "Aye," Ned agreed. "And she's a pretty little ship you have under you. but she's down in the bows, and her sails look like a bunch of dirty shirts on washing day. "You will have to see to that, then, won't you, Ned?" Howell said. Ned nodded lugubriously. "Aye, that I will, Cap'n." Despite the condition of the roads, Arbily had made good time down from London with the carriage, and he was waiting on the dock, sitting on the box with the horses still in the traces. Howell gave orders to Daniel to begin bringing the powder down from the warehouse and to have the Seraph's water barrels offloaded into the quay so that they could be reloaded with better attention to her trim before he called the boys to join him and went to where Arbily waited with the horses. Guy followed his father dutifully, even with a certain amount of relief. On the other hand, Tom and Dorian climbed the gangplank onto dry land only after elaborate delaying tactics, including protracted farewells to all those members of the crew with whom they had made friends. They had taken to shipboard life as though born to it, which of course they were, Hal thought, and grinned. "Come on, you two. You may return tomorrow to help Big Daniel with the reloading." As soon as they had scrambled onto the box beside Arbily, Hal said, "Take us up to Highweald, Arbily." A while later, as the carriage passed through the gate in the stone wall that marked the boundary of the estate, Tom looked ahead and saw a single rider crossing the moor at a canter, aiming to intercept the carriage at the foot of the hill. There was no mistaking the tall figure, dressed all in black, on the back of the black stallion, coming from the direction of the tin shaft at East Rushwald. Dorian saw Black Billy at the same time, and moved a little closer to Tom, as if for protection, but neither boy spoke. William put the stallion to the hedge. Horse and rider sailed over, the black cloak billowing out behind, and landed easily, then turned up the road immediately to meet the oncoming carriage. William ignored Abberley and his two younger brothers on the box, but wheeled his horse to canter alongside. "Well met, father," he greeted through the carriage window. "Welcome back to Highweald. You were sorely missed." Hal leaned from the window, smiling with pleasure, and the two fell at once into an animated conversation. William recounted everything that had taken place in Hal's absence, with special emphasis on the running of the mines and the reaping of the grain harvest. They were coming up the last hill to the big house when suddenly William broke off with an exclamation of annoyance. "Ah! I forgot to mention that your guests have arrived from Brighton. They have been here 2 days awaiting your coming." "My guests?" Hal looked mystified. William pointed with his riding crop to the distant figures on the far lawns. A large, solid gentleman stood with a lady on each arm, while two girls in brightly coloured pinafores were already racing each other across the grass to meet the carriage, squealing with excitement like steam from a boiling kettle. "Girls?" said Dorian with disdain. "Small girls?" "But a big one also." Tom's sharp eyes had picked out the slimmer of the two women on the arms of the portly gentleman. "Damn pretty, too." "Eh, have a care, Klebe," Arbily murmured. "The last one landed you in deep water." But Tom was like a hunting dog on point to the scent of a bird. "Who on earth are they?" Hal asked William irritably. He was engrossed in fitting out a ship for a long voyage, and it was not the time to have uninvited guests at Highweald. "A certain Mr. Beatty and his brood," William answered. "I was told you were expecting them, father. Is that not the case? If so, we can send them packing." "Damn me," Hal exclaimed. "I'd almost forgotten. They must be the passengers on board the Seraph as far as Bombay. Beatty is to be the new Auditor General for the company factory there, but Childs never mentioned he was bringing his whole tribe with him. This is a nuisance. 4 females, where in the devil's name will I find berths for all of them?" Howell concealed his annoyance when he stepped out of the carriage to greet the family. "Mr. Beatty, your servant, sir. Lord Childs has given me good reports of you. You had a pleasant enough journey down to Devon, I trust?" The truth was that he had expected the family to find lodgings in the port rather than to arrive at Highweald. But he put a good face on it and turned to greet the wife. Mrs. Beatty was full-fleshed like her husband, for they had sat at the same dining table for 20 years. Her face was red and round as a child's ball, but little girlish curls peeped out from under the peak of her bonnet. She gave Howl an elephantine curtsy. "Enchanted, madam," Howl told her gallantly. She giggled when he kissed her hand.
"May I present my eldest daughter, Caroline?"
She knew that apart from being one of the richest men in Devon and a great landowner, Sir Henry Courtenay was a widower. Caroline was almost 16 and lovely. There was not more than 25 years difference in their ages, she estimated, the same as between Mr. Beatty and herself. They would all be on a long voyage together, plenty of time for friendships to ripen, and sometimes dreams became reality. Howl bowed to the girl, who curtsied prettily, but he made no effort to kiss her hand. His eyes moved on swiftly to the two girls, who hopped and danced around their parents like chirping sparrows. "And who are these two fine young ladies?" he asked, with a paternal smile.
"I am Agnes, and I am Sarah."
By the time they were all moving up the staircase and through the front doors of High Weald, Howl had a child by each hand, and they were both chattering and dancing, looking up at him, vying for his attention.
"He always wished for a daughter," Abelie said softly, watching his master fondly, "and all he ever got was this gang of hellions."
"They're only girls," Dorian pointed out loftily.
Tom said nothing. He had not spoken since he had come close enough to Caroline to make out every detail of her features. Since then he had been transfixed. Caroline and Guy were following the others up the stairs. They were walking side by side, but at the top Caroline paused and looked back. Her eyes met Tom's. She was the most beautiful thing Tom had ever imagined. She was as tall as Guy, but her shoulders were narrow, and her waist was lithe as a sapling. Her slippered feet were tiny under the flaring layers of petticoats and skirts. Her arms were bare below the puffed sleeves, the skin pale and unblemished. Her hair was a tower of shimmering curls and ribbons. Her face was exquisite, full pink lips and large violet eyes. She looked through Tom without expression, her face calm and unsmiling. It was almost as if she had not seen him, as if for her he did not exist. Then she turned away and followed her family into the house. Tom had been holding his breath without realizing it, and now he let it out with an audible hiss. Abelie shook his head. He had missed nothing. "This may be a long voyage," he thought, "and a dangerous one." The Seraph lay alongside the quay for 6 days. Even with Ned Tyler and Big Daniel driving them relentlessly, it took that long for the workmen to finish fitting her out. No sooner was the last joint glued and pinned and the last wedge driven home than Daniel saw them all packed off on the postcoach back to the builders' yards at Deptford. By this time the cargo, provisions and armaments had been swung out of the Seraph's hold and then in again and repacked, while Hal stood off in the middle of the harbour in one of the longboats to check her trim. Edward Anderson from the Yeoman proved his goodwill by sending his own crew across to help with the heavy work. In the meantime, Ned had sent all the sails to the sailmaker's yard. He had checked each seam and stitch, and had those that did not please him re-sewn. Then he had watched each sail repacked in its canvas bag, marked and stowed away in the sail lockers ready to hand. Once he had dealt with the sails, Ned laid out and inspected the spare spars and yards, then sent them aboard again before the main cargo. Tom followed him around, asking questions and avidly gleaning every bit of sailing lore that he could. Hal personally sampled a mug of water from each of the barrels before they were sent back on board to make certain that their content was sweet and potable. He opened every third pickle barrel and had the ship's surgeon, Dr. Reynolds, check that the salt pork and beef, the biscuits and flour were of the first quality. They all knew well enough that by the time they reached Good Hope, the water would be green with slime, the biscuits crackling and popping with weevils, but Hal was determined that they would start off clean, and the men took notice of his concern and murmured approvingly among themselves. "Ah, not many captain would take those pains. Some would buy condemned pork from the Admiralty just to save a guinea or two." Daniel and his gunners looked at the powder to ensure the damp had not got into the kegs and caked it. After that they cleaned the muskets, 150 of them, and made sure that the flints were firm and struck a shower of sparks when the lock was fired. The deck guns were run out and the carriages greased. On their swivel mounts, the murderers and falconets were sighted aloft in the crow's nests and at the break of the quarter-deck, so that they could command the decks of an enemy ship as she came alongside and sweep her decks with a storm of grape-shot. The blacksmith and his mates sharpened the cutlasses and the axes and set them back in their racks ready for when they were needed. Hal puzzled over his quarter-bill, which assigned each man his station in a battle, then worked out the space at his disposal to accommodate his unexpected passengers. In the end, he evicted the boys from their newly built cabin and gave it to the three Beatty sisters, while Will Carter, the third officer, had to give up his cabin, tiny as it was, to Mr. Beatty and his wife. Those two large bodies would have to share a bunk 22 inches wide, and Hal grinned at the picture that called to mind. In the stern cabin of the Seriff, Hal sat for hours with Edward Anderson of the Yeoman, working out with him a system of signals with which they could communicate at sea. 40 years previously, the three parliamentarian generals at sea, Blake, Dean, and Monk, had innovated a system of signalling, using flags and sails by day and lanterns and guns by night. Hal had obtained copies of their pamphlet, Instructions for the Better Ordering of the Fleet in Fighting, and he and Anderson used the 5 flags and 4 lanterns as the basis for their own set of signals. The meaning of the flags depended on the combinations and the position in the rigging from which they were flown. At night, the lanterns would be arranged in patterns, vertical and horizontal lines, or squares and triangles on the mainmast and the main yard. Once they had agreed the signals, they drew up a schedule of rendezvous to cover the possibility of the two ships losing contact with each other in conditions of poor visibility or during the vagaries of battle. At the end of these long discussions, Hal was confident that he had come to know Anderson well, and that he could trust him to do his duty. On the 7th day after reaching Plymouth, they were ready to sail, and on their last day, William laid on a splendid dinner for them in the dining-room at High Weald. Caroline was placed between William and Guy at the long dinner table. Tom sat opposite her, but the table was too wide for easy conversation. This made little difference to him, for once he could think of nothing to say. He ate little, hardly touching the lobster and sole, his favourite foods. He could barely take his eyes off the girl's lovely, tranquil face. Guy, though, had discovered almost immediately that Caroline was a lover of music, and they had formed an instant bond. Under Master Walsh's instruction, Guy had learned to play both the harpsichord and the cittern, a fashionable plucked stringed instrument. Tom had shown no aptitude for either instrument, and his singing, Master Walsh opined, was enough to make horses bolt. During their stay in London, Master Walsh had taken Guy and Dorian to a concert. Tom had developed a severe stomachache, which had prevented him accompanying them, a circumstance he bitterly regretted now, as he watched Caroline listening with what seemed divine rapture to Guy describing the evening to her, the music, and the glittering gathering of London society. Guy seemed able even to remember what dresses and jewellery the women had worn, and those huge violet eyes had not left his face. Tom made an effort to drag her eyes away from Guy by embarking on an account of their visit to Bedlam at Moorfields, to see the lunatics on display in their iron cages. "When I threw a stone at one, he picked up his own turds and threw them back at me," he recounted with relish. "Luckily he missed me and hit Guy instead." Caroline's rosebud upper lip lifted slightly as if she had smelt the missile, and her basilisk gaze passed clean through Tom, leaving him stammering before she turned back to Guy. Dorian sat stiffly between Agnes and Sarah at the bottom of the table. The two girls were hidden from their parents by the display of flowers in the silver vases and the tall candelabra. They giggled and whispered to each other during the whole meal, or told inane, pointless jokes that they thought so rich they had to stuff their table napkins into their mouths to control their mirth. Dorian was left squirming with embarrassment and terror that the footman waiting at table would recount his agony in the servants' quarters. Then even the stable boys, who were usually his bosom pals, would despise him as a ninny. At the top of the table, Hal and William, Mr. Beatty and Edward Anderson were engrossed in discussing the king. "Lord knows I was not entirely happy with a Dutchman on the throne, but the little gentleman in black velvet has proved himself a warrior," Beatty said. Hal nodded. "He is a great opponent of Rome, and no lover of the French. For that alone he has my loyalty. But I found him also a man with a sharp eye and mind. I think he will make us a good king." Alice Courtney, William's new bride, sat pale and quiet beside Hal. In contrast to her initial loving, dutiful behaviour, she did not look at her new husband across the table. There was a purple bruise on the point of her jaw below the ear, which she had tried to hide with rice powder and by combing a lock of her dark hair over it. She responded in monosyllables to Mrs. Beatty's chatter. At the end of the meal, William stood up and rang for quiet on his wine glass with a silver spoon. "As one who is duty-bound to remain behind when the rest of my beloved family voyages to far lands," he began. Tom ducked his head behind the floral decorations so that he was out of sight of William and his father, and pretended to stick his finger down his throat and throw up. Dorian found this so hilarious that he coughed and choked with laughter and ducked his red head below the table. Caroline gave Tom a single haughty glance, then moved in her chair so that he was out of her eyeline. Oblivious to the sideshow, William was continuing. "Father, I know that, as you have many times before, you will return to us with your fame enhanced and the holds of your ships bearing great profit. I live for that day. But while you are away, I wish you to know that the affairs of the family here in England will receive my unstinted care and attention." Hal leaned back in his chair, his eyes half closed, smiling encouragement as he listened to his eldest son's sonorous praises and hearty wishes for his safety and well-being. But when William included the names of his three half-brothers in his address, Hal felt a tickle of doubt. The sentiments he was expressing were too fulsome. He opened his eyes suddenly to see William looking towards Tom at the end of the table. His cold, dark eyes were so much at odds with the warmth of his words that Hal knew that little of what he had said was sincere. William sensed the depth of his father's appraisal and glanced at him, quickly masking his malevolence. At once his expression became affectionate again, tinged with sadness for the impending departure of all those he loved best. However, what he had seen in William's eyes started a train of thought in Hal and filled him with foreboding. A sudden premonition that this was the last time he would sit around the same table with all his sons. The winds of hazard were bearing us all away, each on his own separate course. "Some of us will never see High Weald again," he thought. He felt a melancholy so profound that he could not shrug it off, and had to force a smile to his lips as he rose to reply to William's toast. "Godspeed and fair wind." At the end of the breakwater, William sat on Sultan, his black stallion, and lifted his hat high in salute as the two ships put out to sea. Hal walked to the rail of the quarter-deck and returned his salute before turning away to give orders to the helm to bring the ship round for the run down the Sound to the open sea. "What course to weather, Ushant?" he asked Ned Tyler as they cleared Penley Point and the green hills of England began to drop away astern. Ned stood by the new-fangled steering wheel, which on such a modern ship had replaced the ancient whipstaff. It was a marvellous invention. Using the whipstaff, the helmsman had been limited to 5-degree turns either side of centre, but with this new wheel he could lay the tiller 70 degrees across for much greater control of the ship's direction underway. "The wind stands fair, Captain. Southwest by south," Ned answered. He knew that the question was a formality, that Hal had checked his chart carefully before leaving his cabin. "Mark it on your traverse," Hal told him, and Ned set a peg in a hole in the border of the circular traverse board. A peg would be added every half hour, and at the end of the watch the mean course could be found, and the ship's position calculated by dead reckoning. Hal walked aft, looking up at the sails. They were running free, with the wind coming in fresh over the port quarter. With Ned setting, every sail was drawing beautifully, and Seraph was flying. She seemed to leap from wave to wave. Hal felt a wild exhilaration, the intensity of which surprised him. "I thought I was too old to have this joy again, from a ship, and the promise of adventure," he thought. It took an effort to keep his expression calm and his gait dignified, but Big Daniel was standing by the break of the quarter-deck, and they caught each other's eye. They did not smile,
but each understood how the other felt. The passengers were standing amidships, lining the rail. The women's skirts whipped and fluttered in the wind, and they had to hold on to their bonnets. But as soon as Seriff cleared the land and felt the full thrust of the sea, the feminine squeals of excitement died away, and one after the other they left the rail and hurried below, until only Caroline was left standing beside her father. All that day, and for several that followed, the force of the wind increased. It drove the two ships on, until one evening it was threatening a full gale, and Hal was forced to shorten sail. As darkness fell, both ships hoisted lanterns in their main tops to maintain contact, and as dawn broke, Ned knocked on Hal's cabin door to tell him that the yeoman was in sight 2 miles astern, and that the light on Ushant was fine on the port bow. Before noon they rounded Ushant and plunged headlong into the stormy waters of Biscay, which lived up to their evil reputation. For the next week the crew had good practice at handling the sails and working the ship in turbulent waters and high winds. Among the ladies only Caroline seemed unaffected, and joined Tom and Dorian for daily lessons in Master Walsh's crowded little cabin. She spoke little, and not at all to Tom, continuing to ignore even his most clever quips and witticisms. She declined when he offered to help her with the mathematical problems that Master Walsh set for them. Languages and mathematics were two of the areas in which Tom excelled. She also refused to join the lessons in Arabic that Alf Wilson gave the three boys for an hour each afternoon. During the crossing of the Bay of Biscay, Guy was prostrated by seasickness. Hal was deeply disturbed that any son of his could succumb so to the motion of the waves. Nevertheless, he had a pallet laid in the corner of the stern cabin for him, and Guy lay there, pale and groaning, as though on the point of death, unable to eat, and only just able to gulp water from the mug Aboli held for him. Mrs. Beatty and her younger daughters were in no better case. None of them left their cabins, and Dr. Reynolds, helped by Caroline, spent most of his days attending to them. There was much spiriting to and fro of chamber pots, and dumping their contents over the side of the ship. The sour odour of vomit pervaded the stern quarters. Hal had ordered their course laid off well to the westwards, to avoid running aground during darkness on the islands of Madeira and the Canaries, and in the hope of picking up more favourable winds when they at last entered the doldrums. However, it was only when they were approaching 35 degrees north latitude, with Madeira 100 leagues eastward, that the gales began at last to moderate. In these easier conditions, Hal was able to set about repairs to the sails and rigging that the ship had sustained during the storms, and to exercise his crew in manoeuvres other than sail setting and shortening. The crew were able to dry out their clothing and sodden bedding. The cook could get his fires going and serve hot fare. A different mood took over the ship. Within days, Mrs. Beatty and her younger girls reappeared on deck, at first wan and listless, but soon in brighter spirits. It was not long before Agnes and Sarah had become the ship's pests. They took an especial set at Tom, for whom they had developed an overwhelming hero worship, and it was to escape them that Tom talked Aberley into allowing him to go aloft without his father's permission, which they knew would not be forthcoming. Hal came on deck at the change of the forenoon watch to find Tom out on the yard 30 feet above the deck, bare feet planted firmly on the horse as he helped shake out another reef in the main topsail. Hal froze in mid-stride, his head thrown back, searching for an order that would bring Tom back to the deck without making plain his concern. He turned to the helm, saw that all the officers on deck were watching him, and casually crossed to where Aberley stood at the rail.
"I recall the first time you ever climbed to the main topmast, Gundwani," Aberley said softly. "It was in heavy seas off the Ogallus Bank. You did it because I had forbidden you to go higher than the main shrouds. You were 2 years younger than Klebby is now, but then you always were a wild boy."
Aberley shook his head disapprovingly and spat over the side.
"Your father, Sir Francis, wanted to take the rope end to you. I should have let him do it."
Hal remembered the incident clearly. What had begun as boyish defiance had ended in abject terror, as he had clung to the mast-top while 100 feet below vistas of the deck alternated with glimpses of the creaming green waves as the ship rolled and plunged and the wake streamed away behind.
Was Tom really 2 years older now than he had been that day? Certainly the yard from which his son was hanging was not even halfway to the topmast. "You and I have both seen a fall from the main yards," he growled. "It breaks bone and kills just as surely as from the mainmast truck."
"Klebby will not fall. He climbs like an ape."
Abelie grinned suddenly.
"It must be in his blood."
Hal ignored the sally and returned to his cabin, ostensibly to write up his log, but in truth so that he would no longer have to watch his son in the rigging. For the rest of the afternoon watch he waited to hear that terrible meaty thump on the deck above his head, or the cries of "Man overboard!" When at last there was a knock on the door of the cabin, and Tom, beaming with pride, put his head through to deliver a message from the officer of the watch, Hal almost leapt up with relief and hugged him to his chest. When they ran into the doldrums, the ship lay becalmed, all sails drooping, without even an eddy or ripple under her counter. In the middle of the morning, Howell was with Big Daniel, Ned Tyler, and Wilson in his cabin, again going over Wilson's description of the capture of the Minotaur by Jangiri. Howell wanted all his officers to know exactly what to expect, and to have their ideas on how best to bring Jangiri to battle, or to discover the whereabouts of his Sally Port. Suddenly, Hal broke off from what he was saying and cocked his head. There was some unusual activity on the deck above. Footsteps, the faint sounds of voices and laughter. "Excuse me, gentlemen." He came to his feet and hurried up the companionway. He looked about swiftly. All the off-duty hands were on deck. In fact, every loafer on board seemed to be there. All heads were craned back, looking up at the mainmast. Hal followed their gaze. Tom was sitting easily astride the main royal yard and calling encouragement to Dorian. "Come on, Dorry! Don't look down!" Dorian was hanging in the topmast shrouds below him. For a horrible moment, Hal thought he was frozen there, 80 feet above the deck. But then the boy moved. He took one cautious step up, then he groped for a handhold on the rope work above his head and took another step. "That's it, Dorry! Another one now!" The strength of Hal's anger towards Tom was heightened by his fear for the child. "I should have thrashed the skin of his backside when he played his first trick in the rigging," he thought, and strode to the helm and seized the hailing trumpet from its bracket. Before he could lift it to his mouth and bellow at the boys, Abelie appeared at his side. "It will not be wise to frighten them now, Gundwani. Dorian needs both hands and all his wits for the job." Hal lowered the trumpet and held his breath as Dorian inched hand over hand up the shrouds. "Why did you not stop them, Abelie?" he asked furiously.
"They did not ask me."
"Even if they had, you would have let them go," Hal said accusingly.
"I do not know, in truth," Abelie shrugged. "Every boy comes to manhood in his own time and in his own way."
He was still watching the small boy in the high rigging.
"Dorian is not afraid."
"How do you know?" Hal snarled, beside himself with fear.
"Look at the way he holds his head. Watch his feet and hands as he takes his holds."
Hal did not answer. He saw that Abelie was right. A coward clings to the ropes and closes his eyes. His hands shake, and the smell of terror is strong upon him. Dorian kept moving, head up and eyes ahead. Almost every man of the crew was on deck, watching, and they were silent and tense. Tom reached out towards his brother.
"Almost there, Dorry."
But Dorian scorned the helping hand, and with a visible effort pulled himself up beside his big brother. He took a moment to catch his breath, then threw back his head and let out a high cry of triumph. Tom put a protective arm around his shoulders and hugged him. Their beaming faces were clear to see, even at that distance from the deck. The crew burst into spontaneous cheering, and Dorian pulled his cap from his head and waved it at them. He and Tom were already the ship's favourites.
"He was ready for it," Abelie said. "And he has proved it."
"My God, he's only a baby. I will forbid him to go aloft again," Hal burst out.
"Dorian is no baby. You see with the eyes of a father," Abelie told him. "Soon there will be fighting, and you and I both know that in a fight the topmast is the safest place for a lad to be."
This was true, of course.
When he was that age, Hull's battle quarter had always been high aloft, for the enemy's fire was directed at the hull, and if the ship were boarded, he would be out of harm's way. A few days later, Hull amended the quarter bill to place both Tom and Dorian in the mainmast crow's nest when the ship went into battle. He was not certain what he should do with Guy, who had shown no indication of wishing to leave the safety of the main deck. Perhaps he could act as surgeon's mate in the sick bay, he thought. But then he might not take kindly to the sight of blood. In the doldrums the wind flirted with them. For days on end it died away completely when the sea was oily calm. The heat beat down upon the ship, and they laboured for breath while sweat burst from every pore of their skins. Those on deck sought the shade of the sails as respite from the sun. Then on the horizon a cat's paw would scratch the slick surface of the sea, and a breath of wind would scurry to fill the sails and bear them away for an hour or a day. When the wind, capricious and fickle, stranded them again, and the ship lay dead in the water, Hull battle-trained his men. He worked them at the guns, watch competing against watch to be the quickest at loading, running out, firing, and loading again. He gave them musketry drill, throwing a barrel overside to act as a target. Then he issued cutlasses from the arms locker and had Aberley and Daniel lead the company through the manual of arms. Tom took his place with the rest of his watch when they worked with the cutlasses, and more than once Big Daniel made him stand out in front to demonstrate a finer point of style to the others. Hull had started with hand-picked men. Almost all had fought before, and were old hands with pistol and cutlass, boarding pikes and axes, and at serving the cannon. After 2 or 3 weeks, he knew that this was the finest crew of fighting men he had ever commanded. One quality set them apart, which Hull found hard to define. He could think of it only as eagerness. They were hunting dogs, questing for the scent of the quarry, and he would be happy to lead them into any fight. They had left the islands of Madeira and the Canaries far below the horizon to the east, but their progress slowed as they ran further and deeper into the doldrums. They lay for days at a time, sails hanging lifelessly, the surface of the ocean around them glassy smooth, as though oil had been spilled upon it, the burnished waters marred only by clumps of sargasso weed and the dappling of flying fish as they skimmed over it. The sun was malicious and relentless. Hull knew of the malaise that could overtake a crew in these enervating latitudes, how it could sap their vitality and resolve. He went to great lengths to keep his men from falling into this quagmire of boredom and despondency. When the battle drills were done each day, he organised relay races from the deck to the main top and down again, setting one watch against the other. Even Tom and Dorian took part in these, to the squealing delight of the Beatty Brats, as Tom had christened Agnes and Sarah. Then Hull ordered the carpenters and their mates on both ships to insert the thwarts into the pinnaces. They launched them, and a crew of oarsmen from the Seraph raced a crew from the Yeoman on a course set twice around the drifting ships, with a prize of a red ribbon and an extra ration of rum to the winning pinnace. The ribbon was tied to the Seraph's bowsprit after the first race, and thereafter became an emblem of honour as it changed hands back and forth between the two ships. To celebrate the winning of the red ribbon, Hull invited Edward Anderson to row across from the Yeoman to join him and his passengers for dinner in the stern cabin. As an afterthought, he included his own sons in the invitation to help provide entertainment, for Master Walsh had suggested a musical recital after dinner. Walsh would play the flute and Guy the cittern, while Dorian, who had an extraordinary voice, would sing. Hull served his best claret, and the dinner was noisy and convivial. With this number of guests, there was barely space for all to sit, let alone move around, and when Hull called at last for silence and asked Master Walsh to play, the unmusical Tom found himself pushed into a corner on a stool and hidden from general view behind the carved screen that divided the day cabin from his father's sleeping quarters. Walsh and Guy began with a rendition of several old tunes, including Greensleeves and Spanish Ladies, which delighted all except Tom, who was so thoroughly bored that with his dirk he was carving his initials into the wooden frame of the screen behind which he was sitting. "And now we'll have a song from Mistress Caroline Beatty and Master Dorian Courtney," Walsh announced. Caroline stood up,
and with difficulty eased her way through the closely packed audience until she reached the end of the cabin where Tom sat. She gave him one of her cold looks, then turned half away from him and placed her hip against the carved screen to face Dorian, who stood against the opposite bulkhead. They began with an aria by Purcell. Caroline's voice was clear and sweet, if a little stilted, while Dorian sang with a natural exuberance. The divine sounds that burst out of the angelic little boy brought tears to the eyes of those who listened. By this time, Tom was squirming with the need to escape the hot, claustrophobic cabin. He wanted to be up on deck, under the stars, hidden away behind one of the gun carriages with either Daniel or Aberley, or both of them, listening to stories of the wild lands and mysterious oceans that lay ahead. But he was trapped. Then he noticed that when Caroline reached for a high note, she rose up on tiptoe. Her skirt rode high enough to expose her ankles and the back of her calves. Tom's boredom evaporated. The girl's slippered feet were finely shaped. She wore dark blue stockings, and her ankles blended in a lovely line into the swell of her calves above. Almost of its own volition, his hand came out of his pocket and reached towards a sculpted ankle. "Are you mad?" he asked himself. With an effort, he stopped himself touching her. "She'll make no end of a fuss if I lay a finger on her." He looked around guiltily. Caroline was standing directly in front of him, so close to him that she screened him from the sight of the rest of the company. He knew that every eye in the cabin was turned on Dorian. Still, Tom hesitated. He started to withdraw his hand, to thrust it back safely in the depths of his pocket. Then he smelt her. Over the other powerful odours in the cabin, of pork crackling and cabbage, of wine fumes and the smoke of his father's cigarro, he caught the warm girl smell of her body. His heart clenched like a fist, and there was a pain of wanting in the pit of his stomach. He had to stifle the groan that rose to his lips. He leaned forward on the stool and touched her ankle. It was the lightest brush of his fingertips against the sheer blue stuff of her stockings. Then he jerked away and sat back on the stool, ready to feign innocence when she rounded on him. Caroline picked up the chorus from Dorian without missing a beat, and Tom was perplexed at the lack of reaction from her. Again he reached out, and this time laid two fingers gently on her ankle. Caroline did not move her foot, and her voice continued clear and sweet. Tom stroked her foot, then slowly encircled her ankle with his fingers. It was so small, so feminine, that he felt the pressure swell in his chest. The blue stocking was glossy and silky to his touch. Very slowly, lingeringly, he ran his fingers up over the swell of her calf, savouring the warm curve, until he reached the top of her stocking and the bow of ribbon that secured it below her knee. There he hesitated, and at that moment the song came to an end, in a glorious ringing together of the two young voices. There was a moment's silence, then a burst of clapping, and shouts of "Bravo!" and "Encore! Sing us another!" His father's voice. "We must not impose on Mistress Caroline. She has been too kind to us already." Caroline's dark curls danced on her shoulders. "It is no imposition, Sir Henry, I assure you. We are only pleased that you enjoy it. We will sing again with the greatest of pleasure. Shall we give them 'My Love, She Lives in Durham Town,' Dorian?" "I suppose so," Dorian agreed with little enthusiasm, and Caroline opened her pretty mouth and let the song pour out. Tom had not moved his hand, and now his fingers stole over the top of her stocking to caress the soft skin at the back of her knee. She sang on, and it seemed that her voice had gained in force and feeling. Master Welsh wagged his head in delighted approbation as he blew on his flute. Tom fondled first one knee and then the other. He had lifted the hem of her skirt, and he stared at the glossy skin, so soft and warm beneath his fingertips. Now that it was clear that she would not scream or denounce him to the company, he was growing bolder. He ran his fingers higher, moving up over the back of her thigh, and he felt her tremble. But her voice was still steady, and she missed not a word of the song. From this angle, Tom could just see his father's foot beneath the table tapping out the rhythm with his toe. The knowledge that Hal was so close, the dangerous nature of his behaviour, enhanced Tom's excitement. His fingers were trembling as they reached the crease, above which swelled Caroline's tight round buttock. She wore nothing under her petticoats, and he followed the curve of her bottom until he reached the deep vertical cleft that separated one hemisphere of warm flesh from the other. He tried to slip one of his fingers high between her thighs, but they were pressed tightly together. Every muscle in both her legs was clenched as hard as stone. The divide was impossible, and he abandoned the attempt. Instead, he cupped one of her small, firm buttocks in his hand and squeezed it gently. Caroline hit a high, ringing note at the end of the verse and changed her position slightly, moving her tiny, slippered feet apart and pushing out her bottom towards him. Her thighs parted, and when Tom tried again, he felt the silken nest of fur between them. She made another small movement, as though to make it easier for him, then moved again, directing his touch. Mary, the scullery maid, had shown Tom where to find that magical nub of hard flesh, and deftly he sought it out. Now Caroline was gently moving her whole body to the beat of the music, swaying her hips. Her eyes sparkled, and her colour was high. Mrs. Beatty thought that her daughter had never looked so enchantingly lovely, and she glanced around the circle of men's faces and was proud when she saw the admiration in their eyes. The song reached its climax, and even Dorian had to extend himself to match the beauty of that last high ringing note that seemed to fill the whole cabin, then hang there, shimmering in the air, even after the song had ended. Caroline spread out her skirts and petticoats like the petals of a glorious tropical orchid, and sank down in such a deep curtsy that her forehead almost touched the deck. All the men came to their feet to applaud her, even though they had to stoop beneath the heavy overhead beams. When Caroline lifted her head, her lips were trembling and her cheeks were wet with tears of deep emotion. Her mother jumped up and hugged her impulsively. "Oh, my darling, that was surpassing beautiful. You sang like an angel. But you have exhausted yourself. You may take half a glass of wine to refresh yourself." To expressions of congratulations and delight, Caroline made her way back to her seat. The girl seemed transformed from her usual quiet, withdrawn self, and joined the conversation around her almost gaily. When Mrs. Beatty deemed it time to retire and leave the men to their pipes, cigarros, and port, Caroline went with her demurely. When she said good night and left the cabin, she never so much as glanced in Tom's direction. Tom sat back on his stool in the corner, staring at the deck above his head, trying to appear aloof and unconcerned, but both hands were thrust deeply into his pockets, and he held himself hard so that no one would notice what he had grown in his breeches. That night Tom slept hardly at all. He lay on his pallet with Dorian on one side of him, Guy on the other, and listened to the snores, the groans, and muttering of the sleeping crew along the gun deck. He relived in his imagination every detail of the episode in the stern cabin, every touch and movement, the smell of her and the sound of her voice singing as he fondled her, the slippery softness of her most secret parts and the heat of them. He could barely contain himself until the following day, when he would be with Caroline in Master Walsh's cabin. Even though they would all be poring over their slates and listening to Master Walsh's excruciatingly dull monologues, he longed for a glance or a touch that would confirm for him the monumental significance of what had taken place between them. When at last she entered Master Walsh's cabin, preceded by her squealing sisters, she ignored Tom and went directly to Master Walsh. I find the light at my seat is too dull. It tires my eyes. May I change my place and sit beside Guy?" "Yes, of course you may, young mistress," Walsh acceded instantly, not at all immune to Caroline's charms. "You should have told me earlier that you were uncomfortable beside Tom." Guy moved up the bench with alacrity to make a place for her, but Tom felt himself snubbed and tried to catch her attention by gazing at her fixedly across the narrow cabin. However, Caroline fastened her full attention on her slate and did not look up. At last, even Master Walsh became aware of Tom's strange behaviour. "Are you seasick?" Tom was appalled by and affronted at such an accusation.
"I am perfectly well, sir."
"Then tell me what I was saying," Walsh suggested.
Tom looked thoughtful and stroked his chin. At the same time, he kicked Dorian's ankle beneath the tabletop. Dorian came loyally to the rescue.
"You were saying that tautology is..."
"Thank you, Dorian," Walsh stopped him. "I was speaking to your brother, not to you." He regarded Tom disapprovingly. It always irked him when a boy with a good brain refused to make use of its full potential. "Now that you have been reprieved, Thomas, perhaps you will enlighten us all on the meaning of the word."
"Tautology is the unnecessary repetition of meaning that has already been conveyed earlier in a phrase or sentence," Tom told him.
Walsh looked disappointed. He had hoped to make him display his ignorance and suffer humiliation before his peers.
"You amaze me with your erudition," he said stiffly. "Will you display it further by giving us an example of tautology?"
Tom thought.
"A pedantic pedagogue," he suggested. "A tedious teacher?"
Dorian let out a snort of laughter, and even Guy looked up and smiled.
The Beatty brats understood not a word of it, but when they saw Walsh flutter scarlet, and Tom fold his arms over his chest and grin triumphantly, they realised that their idol had come out on top again and tittered delightedly.
Only Caroline went on writing on her slate without so much as raising her head.
Tom was baffled and hurt. It was as though nothing at all had happened between them. When his perennial fencing with Master Walsh left her unmoved, he tried in other ways to attract her attention. When Caroline was on deck, he pushed himself to the limits of his strength and experience to impress her with his newfound prowess as a topmast man. He copied the feats of his seniors, running out along the high yard, hands above his head, to his place on the ratlines, or sliding down the mizzen stay without pause so that the rough hemp scorched his palms before he landed on bare feet with a thump close to where she stood. She turned away without even a second glance. In contrast, she was honeyed sweetness with Guy and Dorian, and even with Master Walsh. Tone-deaf Tom was excluded from their musical practices, and Caroline seemed to take extra pleasure in Guy's company. The two would whisper together even during lessons, when Walsh made only half-hearted attempts to silence them. Tom protested. "I'm working on a problem in trigonometry, and I cannot think when you two are chattering away all the time." Walsh smiled vindictively. "I am unaware of any significant increase in your cerebral processes, Thomas, even in times of deepest silence." At this, Caroline gave a burst of tinkling laughter and leaned on Guy's shoulder as if to share the joke with him. The glance she threw at Tom was malicious and taunting. Both Dorian and Tom had inherited their father's sharp eyesight, so they were often sent aloft together as lookouts. Tom came to enjoy those long stints at the masthead. It was the only place in the crowded ship that they could ever be alone. Dorian had learned how to hold his tongue, and they could sit for hours in companionable silence, not intruding on each other's thoughts, each indulging his imagination and his fantasies. Where once Tom's dreams had been of battle and glory, of the wild lands and great oceans whither they were bound, of the elephants and whales and huge apes on misty mountain peaks, which he discussed so avidly with Aboli and Big Daniel, his visions now were of Caroline, of her warm, soft body, which he had touched but never seen, of her eyes turned upon him with love and devotion, of doing with her the wondrous things he had done with Mary and the other girls from the village. Yet it seemed sacrilege somehow to allow those coarse creatures into the same dream as the divine Caroline. He conjured up images of saving her when the ship was in flames and the decks swarming with pirates, leaping overboard with her in his arms and swimming to the snowy beach of Coral Island where they could be alone. Alone. That was the problem that confronted him at the end of each of his dreams. How to be alone. The Seraph could sail on to the ends of the ocean with her on board, but they would never be alone. He tried desperately to think of some place on board where they might spend even a few minutes away from prying eyes, even if he could entice her to follow him there, which he admitted seemed highly unlikely. There was the cargo hold, but it was battened down and had the company seals upon it. There were the cabins in the stern quarters, but even the largest of those afforded little privacy, and all were packed to overflowing with humanity.
The bulkheads were so flimsy that through the partitions he had heard the three sisters arguing because there was only room in their cabin for one to stand upright at a time. Two had to crawl into their bunks so that one could dress or undress. There was certainly nowhere there for him to be alone with Caroline and to pour out his love to her, or to further his knowledge of her delights. But still his imagination would give him little rest. On those evenings when the weather was favourable, Tom and Dorian would fetch their food bowls from the galley and take them up to the bows, where they would eat, squatting on the deck, with Arboli and sometimes Big Daniel for company. Afterwards they might lie on their backs and stare up at the night sky. Daniel would puff on his clay pipe and point out to them how the sky changed with every day as they ran down further into the south. He showed them the great Southern Cross rising each evening higher above the horizon ahead of them, the shimmering clouds of Magellan hovering like the aura of angels showing at last beneath it. Around each constellation Arboli wove the legend of the stars from his own tribe, and Big Daniel would chuckle. "Ah, away with you, you great black pagan. Let me tell them the Christian truth. That is Orion the mighty hunter, not some savage bushman." Arboli ignored him and told them one night the legend of the foolish hunter who fired all his arrows at the herd of zebra. Here he pointed out the star cluster of Orion's belt, and thus had nothing with which to defend himself when the lion of Sirius stalked him. For his lack of forethought, the hunter ended up in the lion's belly. "Which is a more satisfying story for the listener," Arboli concluded complacently. "And for the lion," Big Daniel agreed, knocked out his pipe and stood up. "I have work to do on the ship, unlike others, it may seem." He went aft to make his rounds. After he had gone, they were silent for a while. Dorian curled up on the deck like a puppy and fell almost instantly asleep. Arboli sighed with contentment, then murmured in the language of the forests, which they often used when they were alone, "The foolish hunter might have learned many things if he had lived long enough." "Tell me what they are," Tom spoke in the same language. "Eh, sometimes it is best not to chase after the zebra, firing off your arrows wildly and from a distance." "What do you mean, Arboli?" Tom asked, sitting up and hugging his knees to his chest, sensing a hidden meaning to the story. "Eh, the foolish hunter lacks guile and cunning. The harder he chases, the faster runs the game. Those who watch cry, 'Behold, the stupid hunter!' and they laugh at his fruitless endeavours." Tom thought about this. He had come to expect hidden depths in all Arboli's stories. Suddenly the moral of the story occurred to him, and he moved restlessly. "Are you mocking me, Arboli?" "Oh, that I would never do, Klebe. But it galls me to see lesser men laughing at you." "What cause have I given anyone to laugh at me?" "You chase too hard. You let every man on board know what you are about." "Do you mean Caroline?" Tom's voice sank to a whisper. "Is it so obvious, then?" "There is no need for me to answer that, but rather tell me what makes you pine for her most." "She is beautiful," Tom began. "Well, she is not ugly, at least," Arboli smiled in the darkness. "But what drives you mad is that she takes no notice of you." "I don't understand, Arboli." "You chase because she runs, and she runs because you chase." "What should I do, rather?" "Do what the wise hunter does, and wait softly at the waterhole. Let the quarry come to you." Until that time, Tom had taken any excuse to linger in Walsh's cabin after the day's lessons had ended, hoping for some small sign from Caroline that she was still interested in him. His father had stipulated that all three boys undergo 3 hours of formal instruction each day before attending to their duties in the ship. It must have seemed, even to Hal, that 3 hours was enough of Master Walsh's instruction, but until now Tom had braved it longer than simply to spend a few minutes longer in the presence of the object of his devotion. After his talk with Arboli, this changed. During lessons, he forced himself to be silent and inscrutable, confining his exchanges with Walsh to bare necessities. As soon as the ship's bell sounded the change of watch, no matter if he were in the middle of some complex mathematical problem, he would pack away his books and slate and rise immediately to his feet. "Please excuse me, Master Walsh, I must go to my duties." Then he would stride from the cabin without even a glance at Caroline. In the evenings, when Caroline came on deck with her mother and her sisters to take their constitutional stroll in the fresh air, Tom made sure that his duties kept them as far from her as the ship's cramped conditions allowed. For some days she gave no indication that she was aware of the change in his attitude to her. Then, one morning, while they were at lessons, Tom glanced up inadvertently from his slate and caught her regarding him from the corner of her eye. She looked down instantly, but could not prevent the rise of colour to her cheek. Tom felt a flare of satisfaction. Aboli had been right. This was the first time he had ever caught her studying him. With his resolve strengthened, it became easier each day to ignore her, as she had once ignored him. This stalemate persisted for almost 2 weeks until he noticed a subtle change in her behaviour. During the morning lesson, she became more talkative, addressing her remarks mostly to Walsh and Guy, but particularly to Guy. She exchanged whispers with him and laughed inordinately at his most fatuous remarks. Tom maintained his grim silence without raising his head, although her laughter galled him to the depths of his soul. Once, when they had been released from Walsh's cabin and were at the foot of the companionway, Caroline asked, in an irritatingly theatrical tone, "Oh, these stairs are so steep. May I take your arm, Guy?" Then she leaned on him and looked up into his grinning face. Tom brushed past them with no display of emotion. Somehow, Guy's shipboard duties allowed him time to walk with Mrs. Beatty and the girls on deck, or to spend hours in earnest conversation with Mr. Beatty in his cabin. In fact, both Mr. and Mrs. Beatty seemed to have taken to him. He still made no attempt to leave the deck and venture aloft, even when Tom teased him about it in Caroline's hearing. Tom was surprised that he did not resent Guy's timidity. In fact, he felt relief that he did not have the responsibility of keeping an eye on his twin in the high, dangerous dimension aloft. It was enough to have Dorian in his care, even though the younger boy was already so quick and agile in the rigging that he was soon of little concern to Tom. Although Caroline's intervention had first made it apparent, the twins had been drifting apart for some time. They spent little time in each other's company, and when they were together their talk was terse and guarded. It was a far cry from the days not so long ago when they had shared every thought and dream and comforted each other when they encountered life's small hardships and injustices. After dinner, Howell often invited his passengers to an evening of whist in the stern cabin. He was a keen player, and he had taught Tom to enjoy the game. With his bent for mathematics, Tom had developed into an excellent player and often partnered his father against Mr. Beatty and Master Walsh. These games were taken seriously and contested to the knife. After each hand, the play was discussed and dissected, while at the other table in the cavern, Guy, Mrs. Beatty, and the girls giggled and squealed over infantile games of Loo and Spoil Five. Guy had shown neither aptitude for nor liking of the more difficult game of whist. On one of these evenings, Tom found himself placed by his father in a tenuous contract of five hearts. He knew from the outset that he had a choice of two mutually exclusive plays. He could place Mr. Beatty with the Queen of Hearts and take the finesse through him, or he could play for a two-split of trumps. He tried to calculate the odds on the hearts breaking evenly, or the Queen being a singleton, but the cries and feminine squeaks from the other table distracted him. He deliberated a while, then finessed for the lady. He saw his father frown as he began the play, and then, to his dismay, Master Walsh gave a snigger of triumph and made good his singleton queen. Flustered by this miscalculation, Tom misplayed the clubs, and the hand was a disaster. His father was severe. "You should have known from Master Walsh's bidding that he had seven clubs, and his discard to your king confirmed the unfavourable distribution." Tom squirmed in his chair. He looked up to see that at the other table all play had stopped, and that they were listening to his father berate him. Both Caroline and Guy were watching him, their heads close together. In Guy's expression there was a malicious glee that Tom had never witnessed before. Guy was actually glorying in his brother's humiliation.
Suddenly, Tom found himself plunged into a crisis of guilt. For the first time in his life, he was confronted with the realization that he did not like his twin. Guy turned his head and winked at Caroline, who placed a small white hand on his sleeve. She covered her mouth with the other and whispered something in his ear. She was looking squarely at Tom, and her eyes were mocking. With a shock, Tom realized that, more than merely disliking Guy, he actually hated him and wished him harm. For days afterwards, he wrestled with his guilt. His father had taught all his sons that loyalty within the family was sacrosanct. "Us against the world," he often said. And now Tom felt that once again he had fallen short of his father's expectations. Then, unexpectedly, it seemed that he had been vindicated. At first he was only vaguely aware that something of great portent was afoot. He noticed Mr. Beatty and his father in earnest conversation on the quarter-deck, and he could tell instantly that his father was deeply displeased. Over the next few days, Mr. Beatty spent much time closeted with Howell in the stern cabin. Then Howell dispatched Dorian to summon Guy to one of these meetings. "What were they saying?" Tom demanded of his little brother as soon as he returned. "I don't know." "You should have listened at the door," Tom muttered. He was beside himself with curiosity. "I didn't dare," Dorian admitted. "If he had caught me, Father would have had me keel-hauled." Dorian had only recently heard of this gruesome punishment, which fascinated him. For days, Guy had been dreading the summons to the stern cabin. He was busy with Ned Tyler in the powder magazine, helping him open the kegs and check the gritty black powder for damp when Dorian came to find him. "Father wants to see you now in his quarters." The boy was beside himself with his importance as the bearer of such ominous tidings. Guy stood up and dusted the powder grains from his hands. "Better go quickly," Dorian warned him. "Father's got his death to the infidel face on." When Guy stepped into the cabin, he saw at once that Dorian had not exaggerated their father's mood. Howell stood by the stern windows with his hands clasped behind his back. He wheeled around, and the thick pigtail down his back twitched like the tail of an angry lion as he regarded his son with an expression not entirely of anger. In it, Guy saw a touch of concern and even dismay. "I've been having a long talk with Mr. Beatty," he indicated him with a nod. Beatty sat at the table, stern and unsmiling. He wore his full periwig, a further indication of the seriousness of this meeting. Howell was silent for a moment, as if what he had to say next was so distasteful that he would prefer not to have to utter the words. "I am led to believe that you have been making plans for your future without consulting me as the head of the family." "Forgive me, Father, but I do not want to be a sailor," Guy blurted out miserably. Howell stepped back involuntarily, as though his son had denied his faith in God. "We have always been sailors. For 200 years the Courtneys have put out to sea." "I hate it," Guy said softly, his voice shaking. "I hate the stink and cramped space aboard a ship. I feel sick and unhappy when I am out of sight of land." There was another long silence. Then Howell went on. "Tom and Dorian have taken to their heritage. They will surely enjoy rich adventures and profits. I had thought one day to offer you your own ship, but I see that I waste my breath." Guy hung his head and reiterated miserably, "I will never be happy out of sight of land." "Happy?" Howell had promised himself to keep his temper in check, but the scornful word burst from his lips before he could contain it. "What has happiness to do with it? A man follows the path laid out for him. He does his duty to God and his king. He does what he must do, not what pleases him." He felt the anger and outrage building in him. "God's truth, boy, what kind of world would this be if every man did what pleased him alone? Who would plough the fields and reap the harvest if every man had the right to say, 'I don't want to do that'? In this world there is a place for every man, but every man must know his place." He paused as he saw a stubborn look come over his son's face. He turned to the stern window, looked out at the ocean and the tall blue sky streaked with gold by the setting sun. He was breathing deeply,
but it took him some minutes to regain his composure. When he turned back, his features were set.
"Very well," he said. "Perhaps I am over-indulgent. But I will not force you to it, though God knows I have thought of doing just that. You are fortunate that Mr. Beatty has the good opinion of you that has been denied me by your selfish behaviour."
He sat down heavily in his sea chair and drew towards him the document that lay on the tabletop. "As you already know, Mr. Beatty has offered you a position with the Honourable East India Company as an apprentice writer. He has been generous as regards salary and conditions of employment. If you take up this offer, then your employment in the company will commence immediately. I will release you from your duties as a member of the crew of this ship. You will instead begin as assistant to Mr. Beatty, and you will accompany him to the company factory at Bombay. Do you understand that?"
"Yes, father," Guy murmured.
"Is that what you want?" Hull leaned forward and stared into his son's eyes, hoping for some denial.
"Yes, father, that is what I want."
Hull sighed, and the anger left him.
"Well, then, I pray for your sake that you have made the right decision. Your fate is now out of my hands."
He pushed the parchment of indenture across the desk. "Sign it. I will bear witness." Afterwards, Hull sanded the wet ink of the signatures carefully, then blew off the excess and handed the document to Mr. Beatty. He turned back to Guy. "I will explain your position to the ship's officers and to your brothers. I have no doubt what they will think of you." In the darkness, the brothers discussed Guy's decision in exhaustive detail, squatting up in the bows with Aboli and Big Daniel.
"But how can Guy leave us like this? We swore that we'd always stick together, didn't we, Tom?"
Dorian was distraught. Tom avoided the direct question.
"Guy gets seasick. He could never be a real sailor," he said. "And he's afraid of the sea and of going aloft."
Somehow Tom could not bring himself to feel his younger brother's distress at this turn of events. Dorian seemed to sense this and looked instead to the two older men for comfort.
"He should have stayed with us, don't you agree, Aboli?"
"There are many roads through the jungle," Aboli rumbled. "If we all took the same one, it would become very crowded."
"But Guy," Dorian was almost in tears, "he should never have deserted us."
He turned back to Tom.
"You won't ever desert me, will you, Tom?"
"Of course I won't," Tom said gruffly.
"Promise?"
A single tear ran down Dorian's cheek now, sparkling in the starlight.
"You must not cry," Tom admonished him. "I'm not crying. It's just the wind makes my eyes water."
He dashed away the tear.
"Promise me, Tom."
"I promise you."
"No, not like that. Swear me a dreadful oath," Dorian insisted.
With a long-suffering sigh, Tom drew the dirk from the sheath on his belt. He held up the narrow blade, which glinted in the moonlight. "As God, Aboli, and Big Daniel are my witness," he pricked the point of the dagger into the ball of his thumb, and they all watched the blood well up, black as tar, in the silvery light. He slipped the dagger back into its sheath, and with his free hand he drew Dorian's face close to his own, while he stared solemnly into the child's eyes. Tom inscribed with his thumb a bloody cross on Dorian's forehead. "I swear you a dreadful oath that I will never leave you, Dorian," he intoned with gravity. "Now stop crying." With Guy's defection, the watch bill was altered, so that Tom took over his twins' shipboard duties, adding them to his own. Now Ned Tyler and Big Daniel could concentrate the lessons in navigation, gunnery, and sail management on two students instead of three. Tom's routine had been heavy before, but now it seemed to have no limits. Guy's duties now, though, were light and pleasant. After the daily lessons with Master Walsh, when Tom and Dorian had to hurry topsides to begin their stints, he spent a few hours writing letters and reports for Mr. Beatty, or studying the company's publications, including instructions to recruits in the service of the Honourable East India Company, after which he was free to read to Mrs. Beatty or to play cards with her daughters. None of this endeared him to his older brother, who sometimes, from the rigging, watched him strolling and laughing with the ladies on the quarter-deck,
which was out of bounds to all but the ship's officers and the passengers. The Seraph crossed the equator amid the usual jollification when all those who were making the crossing for the first time underwent initiation and paid allegiance to Neptune, god of the oceans. Arboli, in an improbable costume of oddments from the slop chest and a beard of unravelled rope, made an impressive Neptune. Now the doldrums had swung to the northwards of the line, and as the two ships gradually shook free of their grip, they found themselves entering the belt of the southern trades. The character of the ocean changed. There was a sparkle to the ocean, which seemed alive after the sluggish, sullen waters of the doldrums. The air was fresh and invigorating, the sky dappled with mare's tails of wind-driven cirrus cloud. In sympathy, the mood of the crew became light and almost gay. Howl shaped their course southwesterly, so that they could run on a broad reach, away from the continent of Africa, more than halfway across the Atlantic towards the coast of South America. But they traded the angle and the wind for distance run. Every 10 days, Tom went down with Ned and the gunnery mates to check the contents of the magazine. It was part of his instruction in the art of gunnery to understand the character and the temperamental nature of the black powder. He had to know its composition of sulphur, charcoal, and saltpetre, how these ingredients could be safely blended and stored, how to prevent a build-up of heat and damp which could cake the grains and cause uneven or faulty ignition in the guns. At each visit, Ned always impressed on him the danger of naked flame or spark in the magazine, which could set off an explosion and blow the ship out of the water. Before going into battle, the kegs were opened and the powder carefully weighed out into silk bags that contained the exact charge for a gun. This was rammed home down the muzzle as a cartridge, and on top was placed a wad of cloth and then the shot. The bags were carried up to the gun decks by the powder monkeys, or boys. Even when the ship was not expecting action, several silk bags were filled and laid out in the ready racks in case of an emergency. Unfortunately, the thin silk made the contents susceptible to damp and caking, so the bags had to be checked and repacked regularly. When Ned and Tom worked in the magazine, there was seldom any skylarking or light banter. The light from the single mesh-screened lantern was dim, and there was a cathedral hush. As the silk bags were passed up to him, Tom packed them carefully into the racks. They were firm and smooth to the touch. They'd make a comfortable bunk, he thought. Suddenly he had a vision of Caroline stretched out on the silk bags, naked. He gave a low moan. "What is it, Master Tom?" Ned looked up at him quizzically. "Oh, nothing. I was just thinking." "Leave the daydreaming to your twin. He's good at it," Ned advised laconically. "And you get on with the job. That's what you're good at." Tom went on packing in the bags, but now he was thinking furiously. The magazine was the only part of the ship that was deserted for 10 days at a time, where a person could be alone without fear of intrusion. It was just the place he had been trying so hard to find, so obvious that he had overlooked it. He glanced down at the keys that hung from Ned's belt. There were half a dozen in the bunch. Those for the magazine, the arms lockers, the galley stores and the slop chest, as well as the magazine. When they had finished, Tom was at Ned's side when he secured the heavy oak door. He made a mental note of the key that turned the massive lock. It was quite distinctly shaped from the others on the bunch, with 5 tangs in the shape of a crown. He tried to think of a way to get his hands on the bunch, even for a few minutes, so that he could slip the one he wanted off the ring. But it was a wasted effort. Generations of seamen before him had contemplated the similar problem of how to get the key to the store where the spirits were kept. That night he was lying on his pallet when the next idea occurred to him so suddenly that he sat bolt upright. There must be more than one set of keys on board. If there were, he knew where they must be. In his father's cabin, in the sea chest under his bunk, or in one of the drawers of the desk, he thought. For the rest of that night he had little sleep. Even in his privileged position of the master's eldest son aboard, he certainly could not make free with his father's quarters, and Hal's movements about the ship were unpredictable. There was never any time when his cabin was certain to be deserted. If he was not there, his steward was probably fussing with the bedclothes or with Hal's wardrobe. He discounted the idea of making an attempt after his father had retired to his bunk. Tom knew that he was a light sleeper. He had found that out the hard way. His father was not an easy man to bamboozle. Over the next week, Tom considered and discarded a few other wildly impractical plans, such as climbing down the outside of the hull and entering through the stern gallery. He knew he would have to take a calculated risk and wait until his father ordered a major change of sail. Then both watches would be on deck and his father would be fully engrossed above. Tom would conjure up some excuse to leave his post and hurry below. The days went by swiftly, with the trade steady from the southeast, and Seraph still set on the port tack. No change of sail was called for, and there was no opportunity for Tom to put his plan into action. Then the opportunity came to him in such a fortuitous manner that Tom felt an almost superstitious unease. He was squatting with the other men of his watch under the break of the forecastle, enjoying a rare few minutes of rest, when his father looked up from the compass binnacle and beckoned to him. Tom scrambled to his feet and ran to his father's side. "Run down to my cabin, there's a good lad," Hal told him. "Look in the top drawer of my desk. You'll find my black notebook there. Bring it to me." "Aye, sir." For a moment Tom felt quite giddy, then raced for the head of the companionway. "Tom, not so fast!" His father's voice made him pause, his heart skipping. It had been too easy. "If it's not in the top drawer, it must be in one of the others." "Yes, father." Tom shot down the stairs. The black notebook lay in the top drawer, exactly where his father had said it would be. Quickly, Tom tried the other drawers, dreading to find them locked. But they slid open readily enough, and he searched them quickly. As he pulled open the last, he heard a heavy metal object clank and slide with the movement. Again his heart jumped. The duplicate keys were tucked under a copy of the Almanac and Navigational Tables. He lifted them out gingerly and recognized the crown shape of the magazine key. He glanced up at the closed cabin door and listened for footsteps before committing himself. Then he unscrewed the ring, slipped the key from it, thrust it into his pocket, closed the hasp of the ring, laid the depleted bunch back in the drawer and covered it with the almanac. As he ran back on deck, the key seemed as heavy in his pocket as a round shot. He had to find a hiding place for it. The chances were that his father would not discover the theft, not unless the original was lost or mislaid. That was highly unlikely, but still it was dangerous to carry his prize on his person. That night he woke as usual when the ship's bell sounded the beginning of the middle watch at midnight. He waited for another hour, then rose silently from his pallet. Beside him, Guy sat up.
"Where are you going?" he whispered.
Tom's heart sank.
"To the head," he whispered back. "Go to sleep."
In future he must make some changes to their sleeping arrangements. Guy sank back on his straw pallet, and Tom slipped away in the direction of the bows. But as soon as he was out of Guy's sight, he turned back quickly and slipped down the companionway to the lower deck. In this wind and on this point of sailing, the ship was never silent. Her timbers creaked and groaned, one of the seams popped regularly, loud as a pistol shot, and the waters rushed and whispered, thumped against the hull. There was no light in the lower deck, but Tom moved with confidence, only once running into one of the bulkheads. Any noise he made was covered by the other shipboard sounds. A single lantern was hanging from the deck at the bottom of the stern companionway. It cast a glimmering of light down the central passage. There was a sliver of light under the door of his father's cabin. He slipped past it and paused briefly outside the tiny cabin in which the three girls slept. He heard nothing and went on. The powder magazine was on the next deck down, right beside where the heel of the mainmast was stepped on the keelson. Tom crept down the last set of wooden stairs into the utter darkness of the lowest deck and carefully to the door of the magazine. He knelt beside it, and by touch alone fitted his key into the lock. The mechanism was stiff. He had to exert considerable effort before it yielded, and the door opened to his nudge. He stood in the dark opening and inhaled the sharp odour of black powder. Although he felt a sense of accomplishment, He knew there were still many obstacles before him. Quietly he pulled the door closed and locked it. He groped for and found the crack above the lintel, where he hid the key and the tinderbox he had brought with him. Then he retraced his steps through the vessel until he reached his pallet on the gun deck and crawled onto it. Beside him, Guy moved restlessly. He was still awake, but neither spoke again, and soon they both drifted back to sleep. So far, all had worked in Tom's favour. So much so that the next day he had a queasy feeling that his luck might change. There had been little indication from Caroline that his plans might go any further than the point they had now reached. His courage was evaporating. He brooded on the risks he had taken, and those he must still take. More than once he determined to return the magazine key to his father's desk drawer and abandon the whole desperate idea, but then he would sneak a glance at Caroline when she was absorbed in her lessons. The curve of her cheek, the pink lips pouting in concentration, a soft forearm below the puffed sleeves of her dress, now lightly gilded by the tropical sun, and sparsely decorated with fine peach-fluff hairs. "I have to be alone with her, even for a minute. It's worth any risk," he decided. But still he hesitated, unable to screw his courage to the act. He teetered on the brink until she gave him the push that sent him over the edge. At the end of the day's lessons, Caroline flounced out of the cabin ahead of Tom. But as she stepped onto the companionway, Master Walsh called out to her, "Mistress Caroline, will you be able to attend the music practice this evening?" Caroline turned back to answer him. Her movement was so unexpected that Tom could not avoid bumping into her. At the collision, she almost lost her balance, but caught hold of his arm to steady herself, and he put the other around her waist. At that moment, they were out of sight of Walsh and the two boys in the cabin behind them. Caroline made no effort to pull away from him. Instead, she swayed towards him and pressed her lower body against his, a deliberate gyrating movement, looking up into his face with a sly, knowing expression as she did so. In that instant, the world changed for Tom. The contact was fleeting. Then she stepped round him and spoke to Master Walsh through the cabin door. "Yes, of course. The weather is so fair, we could meet on deck, don't you think?" "What a splendid idea," Walsh agreed with alacrity. "Shall we say at 6 o'clock, then?" Walsh still used the landlubber's calculation of time. Ned Tyler stood beside Tom at the ship's wheel. Tom was trying to hold the Seraph's heading at southwest by south on her unswerving run across the ocean. "Meet her," Ned grunted, as Tom let her pay off a point. With every sail set to the royals and filled with 25 knots of wind, it was like trying to hold a runaway stallion. "Look at your wake," Ned told him sternly. Obediently, Tom glanced back over the stern. "Like a pair of snakes on honeymoon," Ned said, which they both knew was unfair. A cable's length behind, there was a barely discernible kink in the creaming wake, but Tom was allowed no leeway by his tutors. For the next 10 minutes, the Seraph cut a rapier straight furrow through the blue waves. "Very well, Master Thomas," Ned nodded. "Now, from the top of the mainmast, if you please." "Royals, topgallants," Tom called the names of the sails without hesitation or mistake, and without allowing the ship's head to wander. Then the trio of musicians came up from the stern quarters. Guy was carrying Caroline's songbook and his citern. Walsh, with his flute sticking out of his back pocket, was carrying her stool in one hand and holding his wig on with the other. The group took up their usual place at the lee rail, protected from the main force of the wind.